I'm Cassie McCullough and you're listening to The List on RN Summer. Carina Longworth is the creator of You Must Remember This, a popular podcast about the secret and or forgotten histories of Hollywood in the 20th century. Last year we spoke to her about a special series she had recently started called Charles Manson's Hollywood.
Of course, it's the story of the 60s and of how the utopian promise of the civil rights movement and the peace and love ambitions of the hippies curdled amidst a series of disasters. The Manson murders were preceded by the assassinations of Martin Luther King and both Kennedys, the election of Richard Nixon, and the worsening situation in Vietnam, all events which were branded by someone as the death knell to the 60s.
Carina Longworth, welcome to Radio National, or to borrow your phrase, join us, won't you?
Thanks for having me.
The episode in your podcast series on Charles Manson appeared in May this year, just 2 days before the NBC TV series Aquarius began, which stars David Duchovny as a detective on the trail of Charles Manson. Was this a coincidence?
Well, I had actually been planning this series for about 9 months, but when I found out that the David Duchovny show was happening, I did hope that perhaps people who were watching it would find my podcast somehow.
It does provide evidence of the cultural legacy of Charles Manson and the family, for better or worse. Listening to your podcast, though, I had a rather unnerving experience. I felt myself being drawn in, perhaps under his influence, because as well as a dangerous, murderous psychopath, Charles Manson is also strangely, hypnotically charismatic. How did you feel entering the world of Charles Manson and the family so deeply?
I have to say it's been a dark time. not just reading about the murders themselves, but reading about things like the way that Manson did get into the heads of his followers and the different tactics he used, borrowing from other sort of schools of thought like Dale Carnegie and his How to Win Friends and Influence People, and Scientology and even Christianity. Just basically, Manson would take what he thought he could use from all of these different things and use them to get inside the heads of these, you know, usually runaways, kids. A lot of them were young women who had no self-esteem, and Manson convinced them that he loved them and that he was the only one who loved them and that they needed to show their love by doing everything he said.
Yeah, he's immensely powerful on a personal level, even, well, not just women, men as well, very drawn to him. Somehow he managed to figure out what it was that people, well, I'm saying in the past tense, I mean, he's still in a jail aged 80 and still seemingly up to his old tricks. But he's able to get into somebody's head, figure out what they need or want as gratifying, and provide it somehow.
Yeah, and he would often do this thing where he would figure out what he, Charles Manson, wanted, and then he would figure out how to put that idea in somebody else's head so the other person would think it was what they wanted, and then they would make it happen.
It's terrifyingly clever. Now, far from a straight-up biography, what you're doing in this series is really a kind of cultural anthropology. It's about how Charles Manson and his story weaves in and out of popular culture. But it's hard to know which way the influence was stronger. I mean, there's no doubt he was influenced by the culture around him and the kaleidoscope of things, as you say, from Dale Carnegie and Scientology to the Beatles. Mm-hmm. What has been his influence on culture?
Well, I think that he sort of still stands up as being this preeminent American symbol of what evil is. I mean, personally, my point of view on Manson is that he's not evil incarnate. He's just a con man. He was a very good con man who was able to con people into doing really terrible things on his behalf. But I think that you give him too much credit when you refer to him as being this dark emissary from an occult space that we can't really understand. He was just a criminal.
Mm-hmm. And yet there's been how many books written about him, a couple of movies, this Aquarius series that we're talking about now. Is it us that invests him with that power?
I do think that he remains fascinating. I was drawn to this story because my podcast is usually about stories from Hollywood's history that people have either forgotten or that they think that they know, but they don't really know all the details of. And I was drawn to telling Charles Manson's story through that lens because there are so many ways in which he was emblematic of the culture that he was part of and also played a role in the changing of the guard from the 1960s, which was this time of optimism and the sense that things were opening up and there were going to be more freedoms and more things were possible, to the 1970s, which at least in America was a time of great paranoia and distrust. And in terms of the way that Hollywood played a role in sort of reflecting that and making that a real thing that people were able to see as being tangible and part of the culture, I think that the Manson murders played a big role in changing people's sort of points of view.
Yeah, you paint him as a kind of bridge between the 60s and the 70s in a way. And chillingly, you say he described himself at some point as the gardener because, what was it, he picked all the
flowers? Because he tended to all of the lost flower children in San Francisco. Yeah.
But it was a case of time and place.
He was a really incredible opportunist. And so when he was released from jail in 1967 and found himself in San Francisco and found so many people who were kind of in search of guidance, he really, you know, with great charisma, stepped in to fill that void.
And the people that you detail him coming across is just a cavalcade of familiar names, from Doris Day and Candice Bergen to, well, Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys, who played a big role. He liked fame. He was drawn to it.
Yes, he was very attracted to it, yeah. I do think that that was what he was after all along. You know, the family was a way of him sort of being the center of attention, but he wanted the attention of the world.
Your podcast outlines some of the very grisly details of the murders. In the very first one, it's almost what you've done is sort of laid out what the known facts are, and then you've gone back and filled in his life story from birth to where he is now. What sort of editorial decisions were you making about how and why to do that?
Well, when I decided to do this series, the story that sparked my interest and made me think that there were a lot of Hollywood stories to tell here was learning about Terry Melcher, who is the son of Doris Day. He was a record producer, sort of, you know, one of the kings of this kind of new Hollywood scene in the late 1960s. He was the boyfriend of Candice Bergen. And he really thought that when Manson's family went and killed Sharon Tate and his friends, Terry Melcher thought that they were looking for him that night. And that was so interesting to me. And so, you know, just the idea that you could draw a direct line from Doris Day to Charles Manson. And so I started looking for other stories that were, you know, kind of like that, where Manson had some kind of connection to somebody else who is known for something else in the culture, whether it's music or movies. I mean, as we speak right now, there's still going to be 5 or 6 more episodes, you know, detailing the lives of people like Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski, and even John Waters, who was a young filmmaker getting ready to make Pink Flamingos during the time of the Charles Manson trial. And he was so fascinated with Manson and his family that he attended the trial.
Manson himself said at one point in your podcast, you point this out, that the Hate Street area was getting so dangerous at the end of the 60s, that it was time to move on. And in a way, he was kind of right, except that the people who he drafted into the family were going out of the frying pan into the fire. What was going on culturally around those, well, progressive hotspots at the time?
Well, the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco was kind of the first place that these young runaways, these hippies started kind of leaving home and flocking to, because there was a promise of being able to live without sort of society's old-fashioned rules. And what that meant in practice, usually, ultimately, was that people were homeless or, you know, living in big communes without a lot of food. And it started out as kind of a peace and love thing, free love, often free drugs. But, you know, the drugs started out as pot and LSD and things that were going to mellow you out and expand your mind. And then drug dealers kind of saw an opportunity and started bringing in things like methamphetamine and heroin. And so ultimately, you know, even by the Summer of Love, supposedly 1967, but especially after that, the Haight-Ashbury scene, you know, it was overcrowded. There was not enough food to go around. And you had just these runaways who had come thinking that they were going to get an answer there. And more often than not, they found themselves with unwanted pregnancies, with diseases, with drug habits that were really destructive. And so this was the scene that Charles Manson saw and was like, this is too dark for me. And he moved with his family, which was then, I think, only about four or five people. I think he had four women with him and one man. They got in a school bus that he acquired, and they kind of drove all around the desert and, you know, tried out a few other places, but they ultimately settled in the Topanga Canyon area of Los Angeles, which was becoming its own kind of enclave for people who were searching for something. He found that he wasn't the only guru in Topanga Canyon. There were quite a lot of people who had their own sort of versions of different types of philosophies, and they were taking advantage of the fact that, like, a lot of young people and also celebrities, people with money, people who were just, there were just a lot of people around who were looking for an answer. And then people like Manson stepped in to, you know, try to give it to them.
As you say, your podcast series isn't over, and neither is the story yet. The last we heard of Charles Manson was at the age of 80 in California's Corcoran State Prison. He became engaged to a 26-year-old, Afton Elaine Starr Burton. What was that about?
You know, I think there are conflicting reports as to what that is about. I heard one story that said that this woman who goes by the, like, she calls herself Starr, that she had made a deal with somebody else so that she could marry Manson and then she would have the right to his corpse when he died and then she could take the corpse on tour. And she says that's not true. She says she really loves him.
Oh.
So perhaps both things are true.
Yes.
In fact, with Charlie Manson and, you know, with a lot of the stories I talk about on my podcast, often multiple things can coexist.
On RN, we're talking with Karina Longworth. She's the brain behind a podcast called You Must Remember This. She's currently rolling out a series about Charles Manson's Hollywood. But previously, the podcast has concerned itself with the secret and sometimes forgotten stories of Hollywood's first century. Karina, how did you come to be so immersed in these lives?
I grew up in Los Angeles. It just seemed normal when I was growing up to, like, be obsessed with the movies. And then I went to graduate school to get a master's degree in cinema studies, which is where I really started focusing on this time period that people call classical Hollywood, which is sort of loosely defined as the beginning of the sound era up through maybe the 1950s. And, you know, I'm endlessly surprised by how many stories there are about people that you think that you know well, like Katharine Hepburn, Audrey Hepburn, Humphrey Bogart, but people don't know the full story. They remember these images in their heads, like the image of Humphrey Bogart in the hat and the coat and, you know, here's looking at you, kid. But they don't really know much about what his life was like and how his persona on screen was a reflection of a time period and what America was going through during that period.
Yes, the Humphrey Bogart story particularly moved me. I think we always associate him with the end of his life and Lauren Bacall, but in fact he'd been married a number of times before, often being beaten up by one of his wives, turning up on set, having had drinking competitions with her through the night. And if he gave up or fell asleep, she would beat him up even more.
Yeah. He was stuck in a pretty terrible marriage when he met Lauren Bacall. And I do believe that they had a great love story, but it wasn't all smooth sailing.
Mm. That's just one of the myriad of amazing stories that you unfold. One of my other favourites is the one of John Barrymore's corpse being propped up in Errol Flynn's living room.
Yeah, that's a story that's been told a couple of different ways by different people, and then some people say it didn't happen, but Barrymore and Errol Flynn were drinking buddies, and depending on who you talk to, some people say it was Peter Lorre, some people say it was Bogart, a few other names have been thrown in there, but the rumor is that somebody paid off the funeral home immediately after John Barrymore died, and arranged to have John Barrymore's embalmed corpse waiting for Errol Flynn in his home bar when he came home from the studio one night.
Which was apparently pretty much like standard form for Barrymore.
Yeah.
Well, we look forward to hearing the end of your Charles Manson's Hollywood series, Karina, and eagerly anticipate your next podcast series. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Karina Longworth is author of 4 books on film history, and we'll put a link to her podcast, You Must Remember This, on the List's program page. Well, that's the List for today. I'm Cassie McCullough. I hope you're enjoying your RN summer.